Okay, so today I'm here with Fanar, and we are talking about sectarianism in Iraq. So Fanar has written probably a really, comprehensive book on sectarianism in Iraq called Sectarianism in Iraq, Antagonistic Visions of Unity. And he's also has a chapter in an edited volume called Sectarian Politics in the Persian Gulf, edited by Lawrence Potter, that's coming out. So I think in our series on Iraq, we have discussed the politics, we have discussed sort of what it means to be Sunni in Iraq, but we've never really described, as a matter of not only theory but as a matter of history, what is sectarianism, how has sectarianism evolved within the context of Iraq, and what does this mean sort of for the future of Iraq, given that sectarianism is so fluid. So the outline of the show today will be, we're going to talk about Fanar's book that I've already mentioned, and then from there we will talk about basically how sectarianism has changed from 2003 to 2013, and then sort of look at the role of outsiders in this complex political atmosphere, and then end with how has the war in Syria changed sectarianism, and how sectarianism is understood. So let me start off with, give us a definition, or your definition of sectarianism within the context of Iraq, because I think there's a lot of misperceptions and misunderstandings that, when we say sectarianism in Iraq, immediately I think a lot of people, their minds jump to, militias, to, Muqtada al-Sadr, but I think there's a deeper history here that I think, is sort of necessary for the audience. So walk us through, how do you define sectarianism, and, what has been the evolution of sectarianism in Iraq?
Sure. It's precisely because of these misunderstandings that you mentioned that, I hate to disappoint, but actually I find the term sectarianism completely useless. I've given up trying to define it. I actually don't use the term. In fact, the title of the book is only called Sectarianism in Iraq because the publisher insisted on that title. What I prefer is something far less ambiguous, far less opaque than sectarianism, is sectarian relations, or indeed using sectarian with whatever appropriate suffix, the context demands. So it could be sectarian hate, sectarian harmony, sectarian entrenchment, whatever. Because it's, as you said, whoever you ask about what do you characterize as sectarianism, you'll get, 10 answers for every 10 people you, 10 different answers for every 10 different people you ask. So I've done away with the term, although unfortunately the English-speaking world has not followed suit yet. Now, if we're talking about sectarian relations in the context of Iraq, or sectarian identity in the context of Iraq, I think the first thing to say is, if we're talking about the modern nation state of Iraq, born in 1921, sectarian identity is you can't really divorce it from national identity. It's imagined through the prism of the nation state. It's expressed with reference to the nation state. And indeed, the tensions that have sort of simmered under the surface and that have blown up after 2003 relate to access to the nation state and the groups, the sectarian groups' place in the nation state, rather than religious truths or historical narratives of Islam. So in that sense, sectarian relations, up till now at least, have been very different to what they are, let's say, in Saudi Arabia, where the issue is much more of a doctrinal, jurisprudential issue. So I think that's the first thing to say, is that how wedded it is to the nation state and the conception of the nation state. Most of the sources of tension relate to access to the national pie. It's not about proselytization. It's not about turning the Sunnis into Shias or turning the Shias into Sunnis. At least not since Ottoman times. It hasn't been that way. And I think that's something that people overlook time and time again. And I think it's sort of, to summarize it, it's the subtitle of my book, Antagonistic Visions of Unity. My argument has always been that it's sort of, that's why these ideas of partition seem quite hollow, or have seemed quite hollow for the past 10 years, because it's all done in the name of, all this sectarian mobilization is done in the name of the nation state. It's more as Iraqi Shias rather than just Shias, ditto Iraqi Sunnis as opposed to just Sunnis. And it is about who defines what Iraq is, and who has the cultural ownership of Iraq, and what the frames of reference of Iraqi nationalism should be, and who is to be represented and who isn't. So I think, I mean, I'm not sure if that answered your question.
No, it did. So I'm sort of curious. I mean, you know, if sectarianism, if I understand it correctly, is a matter of the state, sort of, you know, how would you, I mean, it seems like there's incidences in Iraq's history where this comes out to, it almost seems it comes out, it expresses itself as state policy. I mean, for instance, I mean, the first place where I jump is the Iran-Iraq war, because it seems like, you know, here you have a, you know, for those, for a little background, I mean, Iran is a, at the time was this very fervent sort of, you know, Shia revolutionary state, and Iraq was, you know, a Ba'athist, you know, nationalistic state. But it seems like, you know, when you had that conflict, I mean, it seems, you know, could you characterize that conflict as, you know, sort of a nationalistic conflict, as Iraqi versus Iran, as Iraq versus Iran? But I mean, did that bring out sort of shades of sectarianism? Because it seems like you also have this sort of, you know, a Sunni-led state versus a Shiite-led state. And, you know, what were the sort of, you know, dynamics with Saddam's relationship with Iraqi Shia?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this, the example you raise is sort of quite typical of sectarian dynamics, or these sectarian flashpoints in pre-2003 Iraq, in that, you know, it's neither clearly this nor that. It's sort of a lot of this is a perceptual issue. These are matters of perception more than reality. Now, in terms of the Iran-Iraq war, well, the first thing to say is I wouldn't just reduce it to a Sunni-led government Sunni-led state fighting a Shia-led state. The Iranian Revolution in its earlier days, you know, made a lot of pretense to being an Islamic, a pan-Islamic movement rather than a specifically Shi'i one. However, according it, a Shi'i tag is perfectly justified. Even in the constitution, they give Shi'ism a centrality in the Iranian state. In pre-2003 Iraq, that parallel is not there. It's not really a Sunni state per se. I'd say the Ba'ath were paranoid of any sort of mobilized, organized religious movement. Now, the fact that Shia, there were more Shia oppositional religious movements than Sunni ones, there are reasons for this, and we can go into it. So was it a national war? I mean, I'd say broadly, yes. I mean, of course, you had sort of exceptions. You did have the Iraqi Islamic opposition based in Iran actually fighting alongside Iranian troops against their compatriots. That did happen. You did have some defections. However, by and large, this was seen as a national effort. And we should always remind ourselves that the majority of the rank and file of the Iraqi army are Shias, you know, reflective of the population, I think. So if this really was a sectarian event, a purely sectarian event, then the Iraqi army would have fallen apart, and it didn't, and it managed to sustain the war effort for 8 years. So I don't think it is a sectarian event. However, retrospectively, it has been seen as such, unfortunately. It has been seen as such. It's, you know, increasingly you come across examples where it is framed as such, and many Iraqis frame it as such retrospectively. However, at the time, the Iraqi state didn't do too bad a job of mobilizing people. I mean, I'm not saying it's 100%, you know, no population is 100% mobilized, but they didn't do too bad a job of that. as the scholarship of Dina Reza Khoury, who's written a really excellent book on this, on the Iran-Iraq War recently. It's called Iraq and Wartime. Highly recommend it. I mean, she shows this quite well. So as I said, there are exceptions, such as the Islamic opposition in Iran. But by and large, I'd say that was a national effort. Now, one other thing I'd add to this, whether it's the Iran-Iraq War or throughout the 20th century, the official state line was never sort of anti-Shia in the sense of, I don't know, apartheid South Africa's anti-black, sort of this wholesale, like genetic rejection. The line was always that there's good Shias and bad Shias. And sort of the arbiter of what is a good Shia and a bad Shia is emotional and genetic, even proximity to Iran. So in the 70s and in the 80s, you had these mass deportations. According to some scholars, in the hundreds of thousands of Iraqi Shias were deported in a really rather cruel way, just dumped on the border. Now, they weren't deported because they were Shia. They were Shias who were deported, and the official reason given was that it's because these people were of Iranian origin, that their papers are Iranian and that they are not Iraqi, and hence they are a potential fifth column. This approach stands to reason, this sort of good Shia, bad Shia approach stands to reason, because for a state to openly and explicitly vilify and exclude so large a segment of society, it's just not sustainable. Well, it's about as sustainable as apartheid South Africa. So it makes sense. And this pattern is repeated across the Middle East, where there's sort of the good Shia and the bad Shia. So the caveat was always, after an anti-Shia rant from, say, a preacher or whatever, that, this does not include the noble Arab Shia tribes in southern Iraq, things like that. So again, it's quite murky. Because even though these people were not, to take the example again, they weren't deported because they were Shia, the fact of their deportation nourishes the perception amongst Shias that they are uniquely victimized, and that they are uniquely victimized on the basis of sectarian identity. And as I said, we should always be sort of mindful of the role that perception plays in all of this.
So, prior to the 90s and prior to 2003, how would you define the relationship of the Iraqi state with the Shia seminaries? Because it seems like, looking back from what we know now, it seems like, the Shia seminaries, in 2003 on, I don't want to say wholesale became involved in the political process, but certainly influenced the political process. Mm. And in the 90s, it was sort of, sidelined and regulated to the side. But I'm curious, prior to the sanctions period and prior to the Gulf War, how would you describe the relationship of the Iraqi state to the Shia seminaries in Najaf and Karbala and those cities?
Yeah, well, it was never a completely happy relationship. In fact, the first, top of my head, the first incident with the Hausa, with the Shia seminaries, came as early as, I think, 1924 it was, when at the time Mahdi al-Khalisi, who is a, I believe, Baghdad-based, if I remember correctly, Baghdad-based Shia cleric, was deported because of his opposition to the newly formed state and its lack of independence from the British. They deported him on the grounds that he's of Iranian origin, that old trick again. So that's as early as the 1920s. There was a period, sort of some regimes used the seminaries to their advantage when it suited them, most notably late 50s, early 60s, when the seminaries were employed, given a bit of leeway, a bit of room to maneuver, in sort of as part of an anti-communist effort to counterweight communist influence. However, these are exceptions to the rule. The rule being that the central state is very mindful and very wary of the, this is pre-2003, of the Shia seminaries. It nourishes that perception that the Shias are uniquely victimized, and perhaps in some ways they are. But had there been a Sunni counterpart to the Shia seminaries, something as robust and as grassroots, I would wager that they would have received the same treatment that the Shia seminaries got. And as I said, the relationship was not very happy. So even before the Iran-Iraq war, Muhammad Bakr al-Sadr, who is Muqtada's uncle, was executed. I mean, he was at the time, you know, one of the most charismatic, one of the most revered figures in Iraqi Shias and massively popular. He was executed in 1980 for his opposition activities. So this isn't something that's strictly, you know, a product of the 1990s. It dates way back before then. And the Shia seminaries in Iraq were continuously emasculated throughout the 20th century with brief, as I said, very brief exceptions.
What has been the Iraqi, you know, prior to the 90s, what was the Iraqi state's reaction towards sort of Shia political parties? You know, you mentioned Bakr al-Sadr, you know, what was the state's reaction towards the Dawa party, towards, you know, political organization that, you know, I guess for lack of a better word, we would call them Islamist parties today. But, you know, what was the state's reaction to them, to being politically organized?
Brutal was their reaction. I mean, I think I can give you a short answer that speaks volumes, that membership of the Dawa party was actually punishable by death. This is as of, I think, if I'm not mistaken, 1979, that law came in. Membership of Dawa party was punishable by death, just mere membership. So yeah, it was uncompromisingly against any kind of religious mobilization. I mean, indeed, in Ba'athi Iraq, 68 onwards, I mean, the state increasingly restricted any form of mobilization, whether religious or not. And it sort of stripped these powers, you know, whether it's the unions, whether it's the Kurdish parties, whether it was the communists. As soon as they were able to turn on any of these organizations, they did. Religion is perhaps maybe the most obvious target and maybe potentially the most dangerous due to the its ability to mobilize. But yeah, it was absolutely ruthless. And that's why they ended up, most of them ended up, you know, scattered between Syria and Iran and elsewhere in the world.
So, I mean, it seems really interesting that what you've described is a very, you know, prior to the 90s, it was a sort of very healthy and sort of robust, I mean, as robust as it can be, Iraqi state. I mean, and now I'm sort of curious, you know, when we switch into the 90s and when we switch into the sort of, this, when I say the 90s, I mean, let me define that for the audience, post-Gulf War during the sanctions period. So what, a political scientist would call the weakening of the Iraqi state. You know, how did the, from that 90s period up to the 2003 war, you know, how did that shift sectarian themes and, you know, how the state perceived Shiites, Iraqi Shiites, and how, you know, Iraqi Shiites perceive the state?
I think the 90s are crucial to understanding so much of post-2003 Iraq. I mean, I think the phrase I used in my book is that the sanctions era was the incubation period of the post-2003 era. I just want to pick up one thing. I wouldn't say the pre-90s state was healthy. I think it's always been rather sick in that it was built on a bit of a house of cards. But it had capacity. I mean, it had the capacity to administer Iraqi society, to control Iraqi society, and to act as the sort of paternal state, providing services and whatnot. Come the 1990s, are interesting because the Gulf War, and this comes on the tail of 8 years of really rather economically crippling war with Iran, and then comes the massive devastation of 1990 and then 1991. Of course, you've got the rebellions in 1991, which left quite a strong mark on sectarian relations, particularly relations with the state and how the state was viewed. But one thing that this resulted in is that the state's capacities obviously reduced. You know, its economic room for maneuver was reduced. Its capacity for largesse was reduced. It couldn't provide the services that it once did, and it withdrew from a lot of frontline services. And some people have argued that this is why tribal networks were reinvigorated, let's say, with state patronage, as were religious religious institutions as well, again with state patronage as part of the faith campaign of the 1990s, to sort of make up for the basically collapse of certain sectors of the state. Now, what this did, one of the things it did, I think, is that it reduced the amount there is to go around, meaning that the state had to be much more selective in who it patronizes. And this, to my mind, it didn't bring out sectarian discriminations as much. I mean, that's not the issue. What it brought out, what it revealed, was the long-standing process. It's been there for decades, but now it came into sort of stark vision of tribal and regional discrimination. I don't think that sectarian discrimination per se was always on the basis of sectarian identity. I think it was the perception that sectarian discrimination was rampant was as much, if not more so, a result of regional and tribal discrimination rather than strictly sectarian discrimination. In fact, I'd say the only sort of facet that I would point to is the state's restriction on the expression of Shia identity. That is very much something that concerns the Shia. It is something that is on sectarian lines for a variety of motives. You know, sometimes it's packaged as security or whatever. But it sort of, you know, access to jobs or access to, especially in the 90s, access to sort of state resources, what have you. I think this was something that was shaped much more by regional discrimination and by tribal discrimination rather than sectarian ones. But the end result is the same, because the perception was again strengthened that we are suffering from X because we are Shia. You know, why is it that an area in sort of Anbar or whatever seems to be doing well? I mean, there was always this myth that areas in Anbar were like New York, you know. And this myth was, you know, you'd hear it very often from Shias that, you know, things are so good over there, but we don't get electricity over here because we are Shia. Well, it's not because you're Shia. It's either it's all fanciful or it's a result of tribal and regional discrimination rather than sectarian. The 1990s also, I mean, their impact on 2003 is huge. You've got, you know, the faith campaign had a big role. You had, I mean, Shia mobilization in Iraq. Forget the forces that came from beyond Iraq. In Iraq was alive and well in the 1990s. And the Sadrist phenomenon is the sort of proof of that. Muqtada Sadr's father created something approaching a mass movement, at least in terms of popularity. And he was eventually assassinated in 1999. But yeah, you see sort of the consequences of this come the 2000s and come 2003. So yeah, the sanctions era, it's very important to understanding what happened after 2003.
I'm sort of curious. I mean, could you, for the audience that's not familiar with, you know, describe the faith campaign? I mean, it seems like, you know, this was, I think in your book, you describe it as sort of, if I remember correctly, a ban on alcohol, and, you know, people started wearing, I think it's called niqab, sort of, you know, covering, women started covering themselves up. You started seeing more public expressions of faith that you hadn't seen before. So, I mean, you know, explain to the audience what, you know, the faith campaign is, and, you know, why it's sort of important.
Okay. It's the hijab, by the way, more than the niqab.
Oh,
the niqab,
sorry, I apologize.
At least to my knowledge, the niqab wasn't very popular in Iraq in the 90s. But the faith campaign, so after the Gulf War, this is sort of, a lot of scholars would say that this initially started, you know, as a grassroots popular thing. It started not by the state, it started by society, turning to religion, sort of falling back on religious identities and religious networks, partly out of survival, but, you know, some even speculate that partly to make sense of the really quite sudden, drastic change of circumstances that the Gulf War caused. Now, the state seems to have picked up on this. On the one hand, some scholars have said that, you know, the state had already been adopting a more Islamic vocabulary in the run-up to the Gulf War. But it really took off in 1994 when the faith campaign was launched. And this is basically the state adopting Islam as a central facet of the state's and of Iraq's identity. And this is stands in stark contrast to the Ba'ath Party's earlier practice, which was, I wouldn't say identical to the communist take on religion, but it's certainly sort of in that neighborhood. It was religion was seen as something that was regressive, that was counter-revolutionary, and you know, sort of antiquated, and it sort of conflicted with back in the 60s and 70s what the Ba'ath had in mind for the modern Iraqi family. Come the 90s, this all goes out the window, and even as I said, there were hints of it before the 90s. But this faith campaign was launched, and it's basically the state's patronization of religion and its enlistment of religion for its own purposes.
So where do we put Sadiq Zadeh? So this is Muqtada's father, is that right?
Yes.
Where do we put him within the context of the faith campaign?
So the idea is that, I mean, you'd come across this quite often, that the regime needed an Arab figurehead to the Shia seminaries. They couldn't have an Iranian one, they wanted an Arab one. And not even of Iranian roots, no, a purely Arab one, and indeed the Sadr family are Arabs. So there is that, and the idea, some have, of course, Sadrists would vehemently deny this, but some have charged that Muhammad Sadiq al-Sadr was basically promoted by the regime as sort of the acceptable face of mass Shiism. And as I said, indeed, it was a mass movement that sort of captured the imagination of the Shia poor. Now, with time, Muhammad Sadiq al-Sadr became increasingly independent of state control, increasingly belligerent and critical of the Iraqi state, and this eventually cost him his life. That is the standard narrative that one comes across regarding Muhammad Sadiq al-Sadr.
So I'm curious, I mean, in a larger view, in a larger picture, it seems as the Iraqi state sort of became weaker, right? It became, you know, the appearance of the Iraqi state to the population became weaker. You know, it seems to me that they started relying more on religion. I mean, is this accurate? I mean, it seems like when we get into the 2003 period, after the state is, for lack of a better phrase, you know, collapses and is sort of rebuilt, I mean, it seems like that the 90s period is where we see sort of a slow process of, you know, of a national identity, even, you know, the actual state collapsing within itself and sort of themes of religion sort of coming, you know, I hate to use this phrase, but bubbling up and sort of trying to replace or even sort of complement and strengthen a national identity.
Yeah, I mean, I see what you're saying. I mean, it certainly became a much more integral component of, you know, the vortex that makes up national identity. It was certainly, you know, a major component of it come the 1990s. Or let's put it a different way, more Iraqis in the 1990s started identifying themselves along religious lines. You know, it doesn't mean they're no longer Iraqis. I mean, these things are multi-layered. And the religious layer gained a lot of relevance and gained a lot of importance in people's self-perception in the 1990s. That's at least how I see it. And that explains a lot of sort of the religious mobilization that we saw after 2003. I mean, let's say the state collapsed in, I don't know, take a random year, 1972. I don't think necessarily Iraqi society would have turned to religion in the way that they did in 2003. Now, as for the opposition movements who came in to Iraq and who formed, you know, the bulk of the political post-2003 political classes, these were religious movements from day one. This wasn't the 1990s. This wasn't post-2003. They were always religious movements.
So, I mean, you know, you mentioned it. So I'm curious, where do we put the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, SIRI? Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, they've gone through some name changes.
But yeah, they've rebranded.
But where do you put sort of Skiri and sort of Iran in the 90s? Because it seems like, you know, what we know now, I mean, post-2003, they played such a big role in sort of the formation of Iraq's government. But I think in the 90s, their role isn't as obvious or clear. So, I mean, walk us through that sort of role that Iran played or didn't play in the 90s.
Well, I mean, let's start in 91, sort of the rebellions in 1991. There were these mass rebellions across the Shia-majority governorates and also the Kurdish-majority governorates as well. But sticking to the Shia ones, there was this mass rebellion that a lot of people, the conventional wisdom seems to be that Iran and Iraqi groups based in Iran, like at the time Skiri, today called ISKI, played a big role in. I actually don't buy that. I don't think ISKI did play a role there, nor did Iran. I think the rebellions caught them by surprise, just like they caught everyone. I think Iran, it wasn't in their interest to actually play a role. They were happy to see the rebellion sort of go away after 2-3 weeks. So I don't think they played a role. Now, throughout the 1990s, ISKI, you know, carried on with their, I mean, I'll be honest, from where I'm sitting, it's quite, you know, vague what they actually did. Nothing that was sort of, I mean, it wasn't very effective, whatever they were doing in Iraq. I mean, you hear stories about sporadic assassinations in southern Iraq in the 1990s. You hear the odd bomb attack. You hear sort of cross-border infiltrations, but nothing on a major scale. And again, now the question is, how much of this was due to Iranian efforts to restrict their activities, how much of it was due to their own efficiency, and how much of it was due to the potency of the Iraqi state? I don't know. But as I said, whatever they were doing, it wasn't very effective. They were probably more effective outside Iraq in terms of the lobbying, in terms of being a central part of the opposition industry that took off in the 1990s outside Iraq, and that eventually got to rule post-2003 Iraq.
I mean, what would you say that prior to 2003, what Iran's role is in defining Iraqi sectarianism? Because it almost seems like, you know, I read through accounts of the Iran-Iraq war. I don't consider, you know, looking at that narrative, it very much seems like, you know, Iran's role in defining Iraqi sectarianism is very much, it's not inflated, but it's very much, it almost seems like Iran is very much pointed to, and very much enemies of the Iraqi state are almost, you know, they're branded as being part of Iran or, you know, or even being Persian. So, I mean, walk us through. I mean, prior to 2003, what was sort of Iran's role in defining Iraqi sectarianism? Was it more of a sort of, you know, far off villain, or was it somebody who was actually involved in sort of, you know, in Iraq, in terms of defining and changing, you know,
at the risk of sounding like I'm whitewashing Iran's role, I really am not. But conversely, I would firstly point to, I mean, it's really an Iran complex. I mean, there's this sort of pathological fear and suspicion of Iran. And as I said, I'm not whitewashing Iran here. They've played quite a nefarious role, but the pathology, this anti-Iranian pathology, is far older than 2003, and it's sort of a consistent theme in sectarian dynamics in Iraq. And it is the bane of Arab Shias, the fact that Iran is a Shia state. That has always been the bane of Arab Shias, because it allowed for their detractors, it allowed for their political opponents to question their ethnic loyalties and their ethnic quote-unquote purity. So the easiest way to silence Shia criticism, or let me rephrase it, easiest way to silence criticism that comes from a Shia is to dismiss it as this is something that's coming from an Iranian agent or for someone who's, you know, got some role in Iran or influenced by Iran or some pro-Iranian. It's just a very easy card to play. And it resonates with enough people for this card to continuously be played. I mean, take how the Bahraini state dealt with, their tentative Arab Spring when it came up. I mean, across the Arab world, a lot of people actually give the state, you know, the state's claims some credence. So when Gaddafi dismissed the rebels as Al-Qaeda and foreign terrorists, no one really bought it. When Egypt and Tunis did the same thing, no one really bought it. But when Bahrain did it, you know, it actually sells because of this fear of Iran. And there's always this sort of question mark, about the Shia. How close are they to Iran? You know, Yes, some of them are you know, clearly one of us, but you know, are they all with us on the same page? Now, I'm telling you, in my opinion, of course they are, but that accusation is always ready to be used against Arab Shias. And in fact, again, to bring it back to the first question you asked me today, sectarian dynamics, particularly in Iraq, were until very recently seldom about religion. I mean, religion really wasn't an important factor. It was much more, I think, the way it was framed, an ethnic thing. As in, you know, the bad Shias are the Shias who are basically pseudo-Iranians. You know, they're not really, they're a potential fifth column because of their loyalties to Iran. So they're excluded not on the basis of their doctrine. It was they were excluded on the basis of an alleged or a perceived tie with Iran. So I think that has had a very big impact, and it continues to have an impact on sectarian dynamics in Iraq. And of course, a lot of this was validated by a lot of these irrational fears were validated by the actions and histories of some members of the post-2003 political classes.
So let's get into that. Let's get into sort of 2003. I mean, it seems like, you know, you have an outsider, the United States, that, you know, not only, you know, eliminates Saddam, but, you know, sort of, for lack of a better phrase, sort of resets the state, you know, gets rid of the army, gets rid of the intelligence services, and sort of the state is rebuilt anew, so to speak. I mean, I'm sure there's somebody in the audience sort of shaking their fist at me for oversimplifying, but, you know, I mean, walk us through. I mean, you know, it seems like post-2003 you do have a democratic government that's built, but it almost seems to an outsider as very much explicitly Shiite, because you had the Dawa Party, you had Skiri. I mean, these are very much, you know, Dawa is an Iraqi party, but it strikes us as sort of a Shia Islamist party. And, you know, Skiri, I mean, everybody, it would, you know, very much a party connected to Iran. So, I mean, walk us through. I mean, you know, how did the rebuilding of politics in Iraq post-2003 sort of change the dynamic that you sort of described to us previously?
Okay. Yeah. I mean, we could sort of highlight, you know, the United States' role in all of this, but I actually prefer to highlight the Iraqi role in this, because I think I would actually say that the Iraqi political class probably needs to, once we get over the fact of the invasion and occupation, just once we get over that fact, so April 9th, 2003, after that, I shift the vast majority of the responsibility on the Iraqi political classes. Now, when we focus specifically on the issue of sectarian identity, you know, there's this thing that, you know, oh, it's Iran's fault, oh, it's, you know, the Americans did it as a divide and rule. I don't buy that, because if you look at the major players in Iraqi politics, Arab Iraqi politics after 2003, you see that, you know, from their inception, their entire career, they were never really national movements. They were sectarian, or rather communal advocacy groups. You know, whether it's Skiri, whether it's Dawa, whether it's the Sadrists, I mean, they were communal, sectional advocacy groups. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's perfectly legitimate. And you get these groups all over the world. That's fine. But they were unable, and they're still, I think, unable, to make the transition from sectional advocacy group to a national movement. And it is, in their defense, it's not an easy transition to make. You know, Mandela, sort of the ANC, or the example that's always ballyhooed about, you know, I think precisely because it's so rare. So the point that I derive from this is that sectarian politics, identity politics, this ethno-sectarian system of apportionment, none of this was an accident or, you know, some nefarious idea cooked up in some back room by an evil cabal. No, and with hindsight, and admittedly hindsight, you know, it's 20/20 vision, with hindsight, it seems that it couldn't have gone any other way, or it was unlikely to go any other way, because the main Iraqi political forces were, throughout their careers, sectional advocacy groups. And it showed in how they viewed Iraq, and how they viewed Iraqi history, and what were in their heads the Iraqi historical wrongs that needed to be righted after 2003. All of this showed through, which is why you have this perception that it is a Shi'i government or that it's a Shi'i Islamist government, whatever, however you want to phrase it. That's why.
So, I mean, I'm sort of curious then. I mean, how did violence sort of affect this? I mean, if you're describing sort of the Sadrists and the Dawah Party and Skiri, et cetera, as communal, sort of essentially communal parties, you know, representing, you know, the grievances and the politics of a particular community. I mean, how did the violence sort of affect, you know, these parties and sort of their political programs? Because it seems like the violence in Iraq, when it hit its peak around, I want to say 2007, 2009, in that time period, it seems very much that the violence was communal in the sense that it was very much, one group of people against another, you know, the Iraqi Shiites against Iraqi Sunnis, at least to an outsider, this was the perception. So, I mean, walk us through, especially with the Sadrists, how did violence affect the violence of the war affect these groups?
Violence is key here. I mean, I'm glad you asked this because it reminds me to mention something I neglected to mention in the previous question. So, as I said, advocacy groups are, you know, there's nothing bad about them, you know, and they're perfectly legitimate. And in fact, on a slight side note, this is something that Shia Arabs have suffered from throughout the 20th century until today, that, you know, it's almost a crime to set up a Shi'i party or to set up a communal advocacy group that's, you know, openly advocates for the Shia. This is seen as some kind of treasonous or suspect or Iranian endeavor. It shouldn't be. I think it's perfectly legitimate. Now, come 2003, the fact that these parties came into, or these political forces came into, a vacuum. I mean, it was a vacuum of security, vacuum, complete mayhem. First months in Iraq, the mismanagement of the occupation, spiraling violence, a lot of it which was of an explicitly sectarian nature. This sort of made it all the more likely that communal, what we might have been talking about as communal advocacy groups, turn into sort of communal belligerence and sort of communal tensions as a result of the violence. There's no denying that the violence that erupted, that, you know, some people still hesitate to call a civil war, but I don't, was very much of a sectarian nature. That doesn't mean that, you know, the majority of Sunni people were fighting the majority of Shi'i people, but, you know, civil wars never mean that. I mean, it's never a majority of the population who's involved in these. But it was militant groups who defined themselves along sectarian lines fighting the other. There's many layers to these conflicts, but the sort of the tag that was attached to it was sectarian violence. Was it inevitable? I don't think it was. I really don't think it was. Even with the, I think identity politics were nearly inevitable, given the background of the political forces that came to power. But does that necessarily have to translate into communal violence? No, it doesn't. And for that, I would go back to the early days of 2003, post 2003 Iraq, the mismanagement, the security vacuum, the open borders, the terrorist attacks, the fact of occupation as well, and how divisive that was. I mean, you know, it wasn't sort of, I mean, that's a big part of it as well. Where some groups felt they had a stake in the new Iraq. And whatever their views about occupation, they were willing to tolerate it for the sake of a new Iraq that they felt they had a stake in, whereas you had others who were much more inclined to a wholesale rejection. Now, in that case, how do Iraqis as a whole deal with the fact of occupation? Well, it turned out to be a very divisive issue. What violence becomes justified, and there's a difference, there's a discrepancy in that judgment as well, with some sections of society justifying some forms of violence and some justifying others. So the violence was not inevitable. I don't think identity politics necessarily leads to violence, but in Iraq it did for, you know, very clear reasons that we can actually outline. We don't need to go into conspiracies here.
Well, I'm sort of curious then. I mean, you know, how much of the sectarianism, in, you know, the dynamic during the violence was the perception of, because it seems to me like, you know, Muqtada al-Sadr was able to make the argument that, I don't know if it was successful or not, but he seemed to say, you know, he wants to protect Shia communities and, you know, the Iraqi Shia from, you know, I think, you know, for lack of a better, you know, grouping, you know, sort of Al-Qaeda and sort of, you know, Salafi and sort of the extremist bent of, you know, Sunnis, you know, whether or not, you know, every Iraqi was a, you know, believed in, you know, Salafi jihadism or whatever. But I mean, it seems like, you know, the argument and the perception that was sort of put forward was protecting one community from another. I mean, do you find that statement accurate, that analysis accurate, or is it, you know, more, you know, just too violent, you know, two extreme parts of the community, of separate communities, you know, going to war with each other?
Well, I don't think the two are mutually exclusive. I think one led to the other. I mean, you're right that, I mean, not just Muqtada al-Sadr, but various groups. I mean, this is a symptom of a deeper illness after 2003, and it's sort of this sort of disintegration of social cohesion, and the solidification of these groups. And again, none of this was inevitable. But due to existential fears, you know, fears of encirclement, whether these are grounded in fact or perception, you know, regardless, the fears were there. And for the record, I'd say they might have been inflated in perception, but they were based in a healthy dose of truth. The body count speaks volumes for that. So there were fears of sectarian encirclement, as in I am a target because I am a member of sect A or sect B. And as such, people would turn to groups, even if they find them unpalatable, they will turn to groups for protection because the state and the occupation were not able to protect people, you know, in the worst of it, sort of when once we get into 06, 07, the state was not able to protect people and the body count's getting higher. And time and time again, I hear this, people saying, you know, Militia X or Militia Y, well, we know they're, you know, they're the scum of the earth, but without them, we would have been dead, you know? So we supported them back then. And unabashedly, in fact, why go far? No less a figure than Ahmed al-Chalabi made this claim. He said, you know, the Mahdi army, you know, did all kinds of reprehensible things. However, if it wasn't for them, there'd be no Shias left in Baghdad. This was like 2 years ago, he said it. So people needed, they turned to them because they didn't have much choice. The state just wasn't able to protect people, nor was the occupation. So one thing led to the other, as I said.
Oh, sorry. I mean, but I mean, it seems like in the 2006, from 2005 to about 2007, it almost seems like the state was just as much going out and sort of, you know, engaging in this violence. I mean, it seems like, you know, I remember, you know, oh God, was it the, I can't remember specifically, was it the Sadrists who were in charge of the Interior Ministry during?
No, the Iski or Skiri was yeah.
Well, I mean, my point is, I mean, it seems like the state itself was sort of engaging in violence that was sort of explicitly sectarianist, you know, explicitly sort of fed into the sectarian dynamic that was,
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I'm sure the future will yield many more sort of concrete results. But for the moment, I mean, something as simple as YouTube can illustrate that point for you. The state was certainly not sort of caught in the middle of two belligerent forces in a civil war. No, the state was very much part of the civil war. The state was so incoherent at the time that differentiating as elements of the state from the militias was, you know, a fool's errand. As you said, for example, the Interior Ministry from 2005 was controlled by Badr and Iski. Now, that was used in the communal violence. Now, this might be speculation, but, you know, just to sort of put ourselves in their shoes, again, here's where a communal advocacy group, a sectional advocacy group, this is the sort of the slippery slope to communal violence, or identity politics, the slippery slope to communal violence. If you are one of these groups who is an advocacy, a communal advocacy group, that prism is going to be quite dominant in how you see things. So when you're in power, your assessment of the threats, your assessment of what needs to be done will also be influenced by this view. And indeed, this is what we saw. Now, again, it was based in a very healthy dose of truth. There were militant groups targeting Shias. That's undoubtedly the case, in a most brutal and callous way. But the backlash was no less brutal. And indeed, they were settling scores way before this. I mean, these groups were settling pre-2003 scores from the moment they arrived in Iraq in 2003. This I have on good authority on countless interviews with people who have suffered because of this, and with interviews from people from the Ministry of Interior itself. This had been going on. What happened in, let's say, end of 05, beginning of 06, was an acceleration of something that was already on the way. The sectarian violence was there. Sort of targeting Shia civilians was there. The backlash was already sort of well underway. There was sort of these Shia militant groups settling pre-2003 scores and sort of expanding their influence and territory. This was already underway, but come 06, this sort of exploded. It accelerated at an alarming rate.
So let's switch gears a little and say, up to 2013, what had been the role of, the Shia seminaries, and sort of particularly I'm sort of interested in Sistani's role in sort of defining, these dynamics that you've described, or not even, did he define, did his office sort of define these dynamics, either intentionally or accidentally? What was Sistani and Sistani's office's involvement?
There's limits to the seminary's influence. I mean, I know a lot of people think sort of the Shias are automatons who sort of are operated by clerical edicts. That's not really not the case. I mean, there are limits to the influence that a cleric wields over people. And Sistani is not the only cleric in the seminary, although admittedly he is the most prominent. There was never a point where the seminary sort of encouraged communal violence. I haven't seen that. At least, when I say seminary, I mean the Najaf, the pinnacle of the seminary in Najaf. They never once said, okay, come on lads, now it's time for a backlash. They consistently spoke against communal violence. But come 2006, it's just the influence wasn't there. They couldn't influence it. It just got out of their hands. And it didn't matter what they were saying, particularly when you can get if you look hard enough, you'll find a clerical opinion outside Najaf who will support violence, sort of on the lower rungs of the clerical hierarchy. But the seminary's role, particularly in the early years, sort of shaping the new Iraq and on certain key issues. I mean, for example, the elections in 2005, the seminary had a role. But as I said, I do think it's quite inflated. Particularly when we come to the issue of sort of the dynamics of sectarian relations in post-2003 Iraq, I wouldn't focus on the seminary all that much, to be honest. I think the political parties were doing fine without the seminary's influence on that. And so in sectarian entrenchment and whatnot, I wouldn't blame that on the seminary. I don't think they... I might regret this, but I don't think that the seminary played a role played a significant role in encouraging sectarian entrenchment. And again, when I say seminary, I mean the upper echelons in Najaf. I can't think of an instance where they really pushed that. There are the lower rungs of the hierarchy that had a more questionable role, let's say.
So let me sort of skip ahead. In 2010 to 2013, how would you describe the sort of current sectarian dynamic in Iraq? Because a lot of our discussion has centered around 2007, 2006, 2008. Mm-hmm. But 2010 on, how would you describe the sort of sectarian dynamic that's currently at play, I guess, in Iraq?
I'd say that 2009, 2010 was the missed opportunity. It was the golden moment. After a ugly civil war and really unprecedented in modern Iraqi history, sort of sectarian division, there was sort of this fatigue, there was this rejection of sectarian entrenchment, and there was this disgust with the violence. There was the turn against the emergence of these Sahwa movements and the turn against Al-Qaeda in what used to be their sort of strongholds. You had Nour al-Maliki emerging as this nationalist leader who did not hesitate to take on Shi'i militias as well as Sunni militias, and effectively so. So there was that golden moment, and it's sort of, for me, it's embodied by the fact that Maliki felt popular enough and strong enough to no longer need to play sectarian politics. He campaigned not as part of a Shia coalition. He did not campaign as a Shia candidate. It was all about, state of law and law and order. And he was supposed to be this strong man, this nationalist strong man. Now, the elections of 2010 were the torpedo in that golden moment. The fiasco that came after the election results and the back and forth and trying to form a government reactivated or pushed people back into sectarian politics and sectarian alliances. And indeed, Maliki then formed a coalition that, despite the token appearances here and there, was by and large a Shia coalition. That then eventually formed a government that encompassed everyone. Quite farcical, if you ask me. And there was no opposition and encompassed everyone. Now, after that, you had this sort of, again, it was sort of like a post-Civil War phase where there was this reluctant, begrudging acceptance of the new order. And for me, this is embodied in the fact that Sunni-majority governorates, Sunni politicians, Sunni activists, religious leaders were, for the first time, seriously looking to the Constitution for means with which to air their grievances, namely federalism. I mean, this started, if I'm not mistaken, in 2011, in some, not all, Sunni-majority governorates, where they said, look, we're getting a raw deal here, so your constitution says that we can form federal regions, we want to form a federal region. And here's another missed opportunity, because what happened then was that the central government unconstitutionally rejected this, blocked it, hindered it. And that, again, just did nothing but strengthen the feeling that Sunnis cannot get a good deal out of this current framework and that the state is against them. Another major turning point was when Vice President Tariq al-Hashimi, considered a major Sunni politician for some reason, was charged with terrorism offenses and he had to flee. Most recently, you had the Minister of Finance, Rafael Isawi, suffering a similar fate when his security detail was arrested. And that was the immediate trigger for the mass protest movements that we've seen since December, I think, they first started. Although those protests, the dynamics in those protests, that's an interview in and of itself. But the thing to say is, of course, lurking in the background here is the Syrian crisis. I think Syria plays a big role in how people are sort of approaching these issues. So one of the things to sort of summarize it, one of the things that encouraged the fallback, the re-entrenchment into sectarian politics was the centralization of central power, of governmental power, and this is something that Nour al-Maliki will have to take responsibility for. And that is what, by the way, that, not sectarian identity, is what explains the fiasco with Tariq al-Hashimi, the vice president, and Rafael Isawi, the minister of finance. It's power politics and centralization of power rather than sectarian identity per se. But, as ever, perception plays an important role in this. And these were the triggers for sort of a movement to emerge or a rejection to emerge in which, a long list of grievances dating 10 years back are being vented. Whereas if we were having this interview in 2011 or 12, I would have said that, there is this sort of post-Civil War begrudging acceptance of the new order. This is now under threat. And we see that in the rising violence. I mean, it's alarming how much the violence has risen this year. And all kinds of rumors are coming out of Iraq as to what the next political stage is going to be like. None of this is helped by the fact that next year is an election year. It seems that with every round of elections, you have spikes of violence and you have more sectarian entrenchment with every electoral round, it seems.
So, for our last part of our interview, I'm curious about the Syria question then, because it seems like Syria has not only, on a first layer, it seems like Iraq and Syria are very much connected politically in the sense that, a lot of the sort of jihadi groups, this is a sort of superficial, but a lot of the jihadi groups sort of operating in Syria have come from Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And it seems like very much that, there's a tension between Iraq and Syria in terms of sort of, I think in one of our interviews, it was pointed out that, the rhetoric has become that, Nouri al-Maliki is sort of points to Syria and says, look at the sectarian violence in Syria, that could happen to Iraq if we don't, reach an agreement, or I forget the details of his sort of argument, but how has Syria sort of affected, the dynamic in Iraq? It seems like the war next door is very much, very much sectarian, and Iraq is sort of coming off, at least go ahead.
For the sake of I know this is people find this a very sensitive subject. Is the war in Syria sectarian or not? Well, I'll say that no war is going to be about just one thing, but sectarian identity is certainly a factor. It's not the be-all and end-all of the Syria conflict, but it's a factor. It's a factor that's been nurtured over the last 2 years. It didn't start off that way. Fine, we get that. But today, sectarian identity and sectarian violence are characteristics of the Syria conflict, unfortunately. To take how it was read in Iraq right from the beginning. In Iraq, there was a clear divergence in opinion where you had significant proportion of Sunni opinion sympathizing with the rebels, protesters, call them what you want, and conversely, a significant body of Shia opinion, not out of love for the regime, but out of fear of the rebels. They did not sympathize. So that was from the very beginning. Now, in these protest movements in Iraq that I mentioned earlier, the show of solidarity with Syria is constant, many chants, some of them escape me now, things like our fight is won from Baghdad to Damascus, things like that. So there is that fear. Now, I'm not going to get into whether this fear is justified or not, because just things in Syria are quite uncertain, and it's uncertain how things are going to pan out. But to think that there are no groups in Syria that are sectarian extremists, I think is absurd. I'm not sure anyone in their right mind would actually make that claim. This does nurture fears in Iraq and hopes. It nurtures sort of the sectarian fantasies, be they fears or hopes in Iraq. So you do come across this idea that once Bashar al-Assad will fall, I've heard this from Sunni politicians, not just the cab driver, from politicians who will say that when Bashar al-Assad's regime falls, the Shia Iraqi political forces will feel isolated enough and encircled enough to be more prone to compromise. Now, that's like the moderate view, but there's the other view that says, for some reason, when Bashar al-Assad's regime fall, that will enable militants to overrun Baghdad as well. I don't know how, but that's also something you hear. Now, a lot of Shias, their fear of this Syrian conflict is that this will eventually be aimed at them. That this is an existential struggle. And by the way, this isn't all Shias, this isn't every Shia, but this isn't an opinion that does exist in amongst certain sectors of the Shia community in Iraq and beyond, that Syria is turning into a sectarian, existential, sort of titanic end-of-time struggle. I don't believe that it necessarily is, but some people do. And this is influencing political choices, and it's influencing how people view Syria, and influencing their view of the future, both in Iraq and Syria and beyond.
So, before we end the interview, we always like to give the guests sort of the last word, or sort of, a summary comment. Did we leave anything out? Did we, you want to make sure something gets said before we end the interview, so go ahead.
Well, I'm sure I'll think of a thousand things once we hang up. But for now, I think, because whenever anyone talks about sectarian identity, they get accused of all kinds of things, regardless of the content. So I think it might just, to be on the safe side, repeat a few disclaimers that none of this was inevitable. What happened in Iraq, there are reasons, there were drivers for this. Some dating to pre-2003 Iraq, some dating to since. 2003 was not the dividing line between a sectarian and a non-sectarian Iraq. It just changed the dynamics and it inflamed something that was there, but nothing on this scale. And so many different sides must bear responsibility. Social forces, political forces, internal, external. There's just it's such an ungodly mess that you can't really lay it on the shoulders of any single person. My fear is that Syria is going to be even worse. I truly hope I'm wrong in that, but sometimes I think that Syria is going to end up making Iraq look like a cakewalk. But as I said, I truly hope that I'm wrong. At the moment, there's little room for optimism regarding Iraq and regarding sectarian dynamics in Iraq. There's really little room for optimism. Actually, one thing I should probably end on, something I'm working on now, is that, as I said at the beginning, in Iraq, sectarian dynamics are intrinsically linked to national identity and then the nation state. And sectarian exclusion has traditionally really been sort of an ethnic thing. You know, the accusation is not that, you know, oh, you believe in ABC, hence you're no good. No, the accusation is you're Iranian, so you're no good. Which is why sort of the sectarian polemics now are employing different terms than before. What I think might be changing, and this would be very dangerous, is that framework is falling apart, it seems, and a much more religiously inspired sectarian entrenchment is emerging. It's increasingly common in Iraq for one's beliefs to be the basis of sectarian polemics. This is relatively new in Iraq. Traditionally, that's not how, I mean, if you take anti-Shia discourse, traditionally, it wasn't really about their beliefs. It was about their ethnic, allegedly dubious ethnicity and national loyalties. Now it's sort of increasingly taking on something that you'd associate much more with Saudi, where beliefs are coming in. And I fear the mobilization of religious dogma. Mobilization of religious identity is one thing, and it's pretty ugly. Mobilizing religious dogma is, I think, truly dangerous, much more dangerous than just the identity part.
Definitely. Thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure.
Before we end, I forgot to had to plug the book one more time. So make sure to check out Fanar's book, Sectarianism in Iraq, Antagonistic Visions of Unity. It's a pretty good book, so please check it out, you know, library, buy it, whatever. Thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. Cheers.
Sure.